Chapter 20. Then when I travel thither at the rate of 6, rather, in the swiftest case, does not my agonized heart become overfraught with gratitude to that supreme beneficence from whom alone could have proceeded the wonderful means of shortening my suspense? What is the materiality of the cable, or the wire compared with the materiality of the spark? What is the materiality of certain chemical substances, that we can weigh or measure, imprison or lease, compared with the materiality of their appointed affinities and repulsions presented to them from the instant of their creation to the day of judgment? When did this so-called material age begin? With the use of clothing, with the discovery of the compass, with the invention of the art of printing? Surely, it has been a long time about. And which is the more material object, the farthing tallow candle, that will not give me light, or that flame of gas which will? No, ladies and gentlemen, do not let us be discouraged or deceived by any fine, vapid, empty words. The true material age is the stupid Chinese age, in which no new, or grand revelations of nature are granted, because they are ignorantly and insolently repelled, instead of being diligently and humbly sought. The difference between the ancient fiction of the mad braggart defying the lightning, and the modern historical picture of Franklin drawing it towards his kite, in order that he might the more profoundly study that which was set before him to be studied, or it would not have been there, happily expresses to my mind the distinction between the much maligned material sage's material in one sense, I suppose, but in another very immaterial sages of the Celestial Empire school. Consider whether it is likely or unlikely, natural or unnatural, reasonable or unreasonable, that I, a being capable of thought, and finding myself surrounded by such discovered wonders on every hand, should sometimes ask myself the question, should put to myself the solemn consideration, can these things be among those things which might have been disclosed by divine lips nigh upon 2,000 years ago, but that the people of that time could not bear them? And whether this be so or no, if I am so surrounded on every hand, is not my moral responsibility tremendously increased thereby, and with it my intelligence and submission as a child of Adam, and of the dust, before that shining source which equally of all that is granted, and all that is withheld holds in his mighty hands the unapproachable mysteries of life and death? To the students of your industrial classes generally I have added in my mind, first, to commend the short motto, in two words, courage persevere. This is the motto of a friend and worker. Not because the eyes of Europe are upon them, for I don't in the least believe it, nor because the eyes of even England are upon them, for I don't in the least believe it. Not because their doings will be proclaimed with blast of trumpet at street corners, for no such musical performances will take place. Not because self-improvement is at all certain to lead to worldly success, but simply because it is good, and right of itself, and because, being so, it does assuredly bring with it its own resources and its own rewards. I would further commend to them a very wise, and witty piece of advice on the conduct of the understanding which was given more than half a century ago by the Rev. Sidney Smith, wisest and wittiest of the friends I have lost. He says, and he is speaking, you will please understand, as I speak, to a school of volunteer students, he says. There is a piece of foppery which is to be cautiously guarded against, the foppery of universality, of knowing all sciences and excelling in all arts, chemistry, mathematics, algebra, dancing, history, reasoning, writing, fencing, Low Dutch, High Dutch, and natural philosophy. In short, the modern precept of education very often is, take the admirable Christian for your model, I would have you ignorant of nothing. Apostrophe now, says he, my advice, on the contrary, is to have the courage to be ignorant of a great number of things, in order that you may avoid the calamity of being ignorant of everything. To this I would superadd a little truth, which holds equally good of my own life, and the life of every eminent man I have ever known. The one serviceable, safe, certain remunerative attainable quality in every study, and in every pursuit is the quality of attention, My own invention or imagination, such as it is, I can most truthfully assure you, would never have served me as it has, but for the habit of commonplace, humble, patient, daily, toiling, drudging attention. Genius, vivacity, quickness of penetration, brilliance I in association of ideas such mental qualities, like the qualities of the apparition of the externally armed head in Macbeth, will not be commanded. But attention, after due term of submissive service, always will. Like certain plants which the poorest peasant may grow in the poorest soil, it can be cultivated by anyone, and it is certain in its own good season, to bring forth flowers and fruit. I can most truthfully assure you, by the by, that this eulogium on attention is so far quite disinterested on my part as that it is not the least reference whatever to the attention with which you have honored me. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have done. I cannot but reflect how often you have probably heard within these walls one of the foremost men, and certainly one of the very best speakers, if not the very best, in England. I could not say to myself, when I began just now, in Shakespeare's line, I will be bright and shining gold. But I could say to myself, and I did say to myself, I will be as natural and easy as I possibly can, because my heart has all been in my subject, and I bear an old love towards Birmingham and Birmingham men. I have said, that I bear an old love towards Birmingham and Birmingham men. Let me amend a small omission, and add, and Birmingham women. This ring I wear on my finger now is an old Birmingham gift, and if by rubbing it, I could raise the spirit that was obedient to Aladdin's ring, I heartily assure you that my first instruction to that genius on the spot should be to place himself at Birmingham's disposal in the best of causes. In acknowledging the vote of thanks, Mr. Dickens said, "Ladies and gentlemen, as I hope it is more than possible that I shall have the pleasure of meeting you again before Christmas is out, and shall have the great interest of seeing the faces and touching the bands of the successful competitors in your lists, I will not cast upon that anticipated meeting the terrible foreshadowing of dread which must inevitably result from a second speech. I thank you most heartily, and I most sincerely and fervently say to you, good night, and God bless you." In reference to the appropriate and excellent remarks of Mr. Dixon, I will now discharge my conscience of my political creed, which is contained in two articles, and has no reference to any party or persons. My faith in the people governing is, on the whole, infinitesimal. My faith in the people governed is, on the whole, illimitable. Speech. Birmingham, January 6, 1870. On the evening of the above date, Mr. Dickens, as president of the Birmingham and Midland Institute, distributed the prizes and certificates awarded to the most successful students in the first year. The proceedings took place in the town hall. Mr. Dickens entered at 8 o'clock, accompanied by the officers of the Institute, and was received with loud applause. After the lapse of a minute or two, he rose and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, when I last had the honor to preside over a meeting of the institution which again brings us together, I took occasion to remark upon a certain superabundance of public speaking which seems to me to distinguish the present time. It will require very little self-denial on my part to practice now what I preached then. Firstly, because I said my little say that night, and secondly, because we have definite and highly interesting action before us tonight. We have now to bestow the rewards which have been brilliantly won by the most successful competitors in the society's lists. I say the most successful, because tonight we should particularly observe, I think, that there is success in all honest endeavor, and that there is some victory gained in every gallant struggle that is made. To strive at all involves a victory achieved over sloth, inertness, and indifference, and competition for these prizes involves, besides, in the vast majority of cases, competition with and mastery asserted over circumstances adverse to the effort made. Therefore, every losing competitor among my peers may be certain that he has still won much, very much, and that he can well afford to swell the triumph of his rivals who have passed him in the race. I have applied the word rewards to these prizes, and I do so not because they represent any great intrinsic worth in silver or gold, but precisely because they do not. They represent what is above all price, what can be stated in no arithmetical figures, and what is one of the great needs of the human soul, encouraging sympathy. They are an assurance to every student present, or to come in your institution, that he does not work either neglected or unfriended, and that he is watched, felt for, stimulated, and appreciated. Such an assurance, conveyed in the presence of this large assembly, and striking to the breasts of the recipients that thrill which is inseparable from any great united utterance of feeling, is a reward, to my thinking, as purely worthy of the labor as the labor itself is worthy of the reward, and by a sensitive spirit can never be forgotten. One of the prize takers was a Miss Winkle, a name suggestive of Pickwick, which was received with laughter. Mr. Dickens made some remarks to the lady in an undertone, and then observed to the audience, "I have recommended Miss Winkle to change her name." The prizes having been distributed, Mr. Dickens made a second brief speech. He said, "The prizes are now all distributed, and I have discharged myself of the delightful task you have entrusted to me. And if the recipients of these prizes and certificates who have come upon this platform have had the genuine pleasure in receiving their acknowledgments from my hands that I have had in placing them in theirs, they are in a true Christian temper tonight. I have the painful sense upon me that it is reserved for someone else to enjoy this great satisfaction of mine next time. It would be useless for the few short moments longer to disguise the fact that I happen to have drawn king this 12th night, but that another sovereign will very soon sit upon my inconstant throne. Tonight I abdicate, or, what is much the same thing in the modern annals of royalty, I am politely dethroned. This melancholy reflection, ladies and gentlemen, brings me to a very small point, personal to myself, upon which I will beg your permission to say a closing word. When I was here last autumn, I made, in reference to some remarks of your respected member, Mr. Dixon, a short confession of my political faith, or perhaps I should better say want of faith. It imported that I have very little confidence in the people who govern us. Please to observe, people there will be with a small p, but that I have great confidence in the people whom they govern. Please to observe, people there with a large p. This was shortly and elliptically stated, and was with no evil intention, I am absolutely sure, in some quarters inversely explained. Perhaps as the inventor of a certain extravagant fiction, but one which I do see rather frequently quoted, as if there were grains of truth at the bottom of it, a fiction called the Circumlocution Office, and perhaps also as the writer of an idle book or two, whose public opinions are not obscurely stated, perhaps in these respects I do not sufficiently bear in mind Hamlet's caution, to speak by the card lest equivocation should undo me. Now I complain of nobody, but simply in order that there may be no mistake as to what I did mean, and as to what I do mean, I will restate my meaning, and I will do so in the words of a great thinker, a great writer, and a great scholar, 19, whose death, unfortunately for mankind, cut short his history of civilization in England. They may talk as they will about the reforms which government has introduced and improvements to be expected from legislation, but whoever will take a wider and more commanding view of human affairs will soon discover that such hopes are chimerical. They will learn that lawgivers are nearly always the obstructors of society instead of its helpers, and that in the extremely few cases where their measures have turned out well, their success has been owing to the fact that, contrary to their usual custom, they have implicitly obeyed the spirit of their time, and have been as they always should be, the mere servants of the people, to whose wishes they are bound, to give a public and legal sanction. Speech. London, April 6, 1846. 20. The first anniversary festival of the General Theatrical Fund Association was held on the evening of the above date at the London Tavern. The chair was taken by Mr. Dickens, who thus proposed the principal toast.
Gentlemen, in offering to you a toast which has not as yet been publicly drunk in any company, it becomes incumbent on me to offer a few words in explanation. In the first place, premising that the toast will be the General Theatrical Fund. The association, whose anniversary we celebrate tonight, was founded 7 years ago, for the purpose of granting permanent pensions to such of the corps dramatique as had retired from the stage, either from a decline in their years, or a decay of their powers. Collected within the scope of its benevolence, are all actors and actresses, singers, or dancers, of 5 years standing in the profession. To relieve their necessities, and to protect them from want, is the great end of the society, and it is good to know that for 7 years the members of it have steadily, patiently, quietly, and perseveringly pursued this end, advancing by regular contribution, monies which many of them could ill afford, and cheered by no external help or assistance of any kind whatsoever. It has thus served a regular apprenticeship, but I trust that we shall establish tonight that its time is out, and that henceforth the fund will enter upon a flourishing and brilliant career. I have no doubt that you are all aware that there are, and were when this institution was founded, two other institutions existing of a similar nature, Covent Garden and Drury Lane, both of long standing, both richly endowed. It cannot, however, be too distinctly understood that the present institution is not in any way adverse to those. How can it be when it is only a wide and broad extension of all that is most excellent in the principles on which they are founded? That such an extension was absolutely necessary was sufficiently proved by the fact that the great body of the dramatic corps were excluded from the benefits conferred by a membership of either of these institutions. For it was essential, in order to become a member of the Drury Lane Society, that the applicant, either he or she, should have been engaged for 3 consecutive seasons as a performer. This was afterwards reduced, in the case of Covent Garden, to a period of 2 years, but it really is as exclusive one way as the other, for I need not tell you that Covent Garden is now but a vision of the past. You might play the bottle conjurer with its dramatic company, and put them all into a pint bottle. The human voice is rarely heard within its walls, save in connection with corn, or the ambidextrous prestidigitation of the Wizard of the North. In like manner, Drury Lane is conducted now with almost a sole view to the opera and ballet, insomuch that the statue of Shakespeare over the door serves as emphatically to point out his grave as his bust did in the church of Stratford upon Avon. How can the profession generally hope to qualify for the Drury Lane or Covent Garden institution, when the oldest and most distinguished members have been driven from the boards on which they have earned their reputations, to delight the town in theaters to which the General Theatrical Fund alone extended? Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.